The following program is sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
Good evening and welcome to From the Median, where we are concerned with the middle ground, not just to understand both sides of an argument, but also to awaken the consciences of those who are neutral or indifferent to this, the greatest civil rights movement of all times, the pro-life movement. This evening, we continue our Bringing America Back to Life series. Tonight, we will feature a presentation from our 2023 convention. Our speakers' ideas will inspire you with principles, experiences, and wisdom as they join us to pave the way back to life through prayer, action, voting, and education. I am pleased to introduce to you Austin Roos, speaker, activist, journalist, and author. Austin spent many years in the New York magazine world, working at senior levels at Fortune, Forbes, The Atlantic Monthly, and even Rolling Stone. After a religious and political conversion, he left that world. He began volunteering with a Catholic priest in New York City, waiting for a chance to combine religion and politics in his professional life. That chance came in the summer of 1997, when he met a Canadian team who had raised money to open a pro-life lobbying group at the United Nations. And Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, CFAM, was born. Austin was one of the first employees and has held the title of president since 2000. Since then, he has lectured worldwide and given hundreds of radio, podcast, and television interviews. His talk, How a Ragtag Band of Faithful Christians Stopped the Sexual Left at the United Nations, will inspire you to defend life boldly.
You know, I was a little bit worried. You know, I looked in earlier, and for Posobiec, how do you say his name? Posobiec. Every seat was taken, so I'm glad. It looked a little sparse in the beginning when I first came in here with you guys, so I'm glad everybody is here. You know, we are living through one of the darkest times in the history of our country, very dark time for the church as well, and you're thinking, oh no, another doom and gloom talk. But to all that, I say amen, alleluia, because he sent us. I mean, how crazy is that? He sent the likes of us. If you've seen The Chosen, you know that the those guys weren't exactly the A-team either, you know? None of those guys went to Harvard or worked for Google. You know, maybe Matthew, you know, because he worked for the Romans. But he sent us at this dark time, and I think that's amazing. My little joke is that he sent us so that he could have all the credit. And we happily give it to him, don't we? I have appeared at, I figured it out this morning, 21% of these conferences. Thank you so much for having me back. I love Molly. I love to talk to her on the radio, all sorts of stuff. So let me tell you, start with a little story. many years ago, I was sitting in my house in Northern Virginia, you know, reading a book and doing email or whatever, and I got a text from one of my board members, and he said, and the text was, "Are you almost here?" And I wrote back and I said, "Am I almost where?" And he said, "To the panel you're going to be presenting at here at Franciscan University at Steubenville." And I went, oh no, I forgot completely. This talk didn't get into my calendar, so I had to stand up that lovely conference. So fast forward to yesterday morning. I'm sitting in my daughter's school, Oakcrest, in Vienna, Virginia, meeting with teachers, you know, parent-teacher conferences and things like that, and I get an email from one of Jennifer Roback Morse's guys, and he said, so you'll meet us in the lobby in 20 minutes? Oh, no, I've done it again. So I had this in another week, and I think that Molly switched it on me, you know, and didn't tell me. So anyway, so I immediately called Molly, I called Janine Jones, I texted and emailed everybody, I emailed Michael Voris, and I said, can you switch with me? And like within an hour, everything was changed. It was like a triple switch. And I got in my car and drove 6 hours in the rain. And I am here. And I'm happy to be with you. The first thing that you should know about me is that my organization is on the hate list of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I don't care. I don't care. How did we get there? We got on this list because years and years ago, the government of Belize asked us a legal question. They wanted to know if they had a legal obligation to legalize a particular nasty sexual act that a certain subset of people commit. I'm not going to say it. They make us say the most awful things in public, don't they? But I'm not going to say it. So Belize wanted to know if there was a treaty obligation to legalize this particular act. And we told them no. You know, Belize had been under pressure from international organizations and lawyers groups and judges groups saying that there was a treaty obligation to legalize this particular act. Now, there's no such thing. There wasn't then, there wasn't now. But telling Belize that there was no treaty obligation to legalize this particular act landed us on the SPLC hate list. Go figure. What they're really angry about is that there is no international right to abortion because we stopped it. There is no international obligation to recognize sexual orientation and gender identity in international law because we stopped it. There's no redefinition of the family because we stopped it. We have been working at the United Nations, like I said, a ragtag band of Christians that you've never heard of, working daily to protect life, faith, and family, and consistently for 25 years, we have stopped them. And I'm going to tell you how. The pro-life and pro-family movement at the international level was founded by John Paul II prior to the Cairo conference in 1994. He gave a series of Wednesday audiences, like week after week after week, and he was saying, please, you guys have to come to Cairo because they're going to be negotiating a document and they're going to try to make abortion an internationally recognized human right. He did this week after week after week. And about the number, how many people are in this room? 600? The number of people in this room went out and raised their own money, bought their tickets to Cairo, went to the Cairo Conference on Population and Development in 1994, and stopped the global right to abortion. It was a ragtag band of regular people, just like you and me, answered that call of JP2. A year later was the Beijing Women's Conference, where they tried to do it again. A similar number of people answered that call, and they stopped a right to abortion then. That is how we were founded. A couple of years after that, the Holy See Mission to the United Nations decided that there needed to be a full-time office of laymen working at the United Nations on these issues every day. Now, I spent many years in the magazine publishing business in New York City. I worked at Fortune, Forbes, The Atlantic Monthly, Rolling Stone, and I had a religious and a political conversion. Reagan, JP2, 1-2 punch. And wanted to combine those two things, so I walked away from the magazine publishing business and volunteered my time with Father John Perricone, who ran a wonderful catechetical group in New York City called Christi Fidelis. We did amazing work, catechetical work in conferences and masses, and it was phenomenal what we were able to do in New York City. We put on the traditional Latin Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral the first time in 40 years, and 4,500 people attended. That's the kind of stuff we did. And so I was working for Father Perricone for free, and I was temping. You know, I was had big jobs in magazine publishing, and I was temping because I didn't want to go back to the money. I wanted to do this work. And so I temped. I love temping. You know, it's like I was a full-time temp, you know, for several months. That is funny, isn't it? Full-time temp. And then one day after Mass, this young lady joined us for breakfast, and what are you doing here? And she says, I represent Human Life International Canada, and we've raised a bunch of money to open up a pro-life lobbying group at the United Nations. And I heard bells ringing, because this incorporates international affairs, which is what I wanted to do, politics, and my faith. And so I leaned across the table and I said, that job is mine. And a few weeks later, it was. And I've never done anything else, not since that day, not since the summer of 1997. That's how the pro-life movement was founded at the international level. That's how CFAM was founded, and that's how I came to it. And I'm here to tell you that the people at the United Nations really hate us. I thank you. You know, when my guys show up at one of these conferences where they're negotiating a document, you can feel the air just go right out of the room. They're going, oh, no, those guys. Oh, no. They, for years, blocked Human Life International from becoming an accredited UN NGO because of something that Father Mark said. And it still follows HLI to this day. And so all sorts of pro-life organizations were very timid about actually applying for UN accreditation. A few did. CFAM didn't. We waited many, many years to apply for UN accreditation. And when we did, they blocked us. It was so strange. We got blocked by a coalition of Israel, Turkey, with the United States in the background pulling the strings. And it was all over the question of abortion. We love Israel on the social issues. They're terrible. So that they've worked very hard to block pro-life NGOs. We eventually got accredited, and we have badges and all that kind of stuff. But they have tried so many various kinds of tricks to keep us out of UN negotiations. At Beijing Plus Five, we accredited 300 volunteers. You go to a desk and you check in, and the volunteers get their badge, and we gave them the list to make it easier for them to check people in, and they stole it. You know, it's like silly stuff like that. They used to have UN security follow us around because they said, oh, you know, we think they're dangerous. We think they're violent. Does that sound at all familiar? Years ago, I went to Kosovo during the Kosovo war, and I was tracking down so-called reproductive health kits that the United Nations Population Fund sent into this refugee crisis. When there's a refugee crisis, their number one answer is reproductive health kits. It's portable abortion devices. You see it right now in the Ukraine crisis. And so I went to Kosovo to find these reproductive health kits and find a manual vacuum aspirator. Anybody ever seen a manual vacuum aspirator? It's a miniature abortion device. It's a nasty-looking device. Anyway, it was in every single reproductive health kit so that they could perform abortions in refugee tents. And I suggested in something that I wrote afterwards that they were in lockstep with the Serbs who were trying to wipe out the Kosovars because they were trying to get the Kosovars to stop breeding. They wanted fewer Kosovars. So the UN Population Fund said that I was calling for genocide against UNFPA personnel, and they put this on the front page of their website. They fight dirty, these people. They call us terrorists. They call us terrorists. The UN NGO committee just a month ago in New York issued new guidelines for the participation of NGOs on what's known as the NGO track at the Commission on the Status of Women, which is going on right now. And it's something that none of us could agree to, these values, intersectionality and sexual orientation, gender identity, and all that kind of stuff. And in the private meeting where they were deciding these new rules, one of these people called us terrorists and specifically mentioned my organization. I'll get to the Commission on the Status of Women in a second. Now, who are we up against? We're up against all the powers of the earth, you know? We're up against the United Nations agencies, including UNICEF. You know, you guys know this. UNICEF went bad a long time ago. When I was a kid back in the 60s, we used to collect for UNICEF around Halloween, And there were some of these lunatic people at the door said, oh, no, they're communists. And now I realize they were right. we made fun of those guys, and now I'm one of them. So UNICEF, we're up against UNICEF. They have $1 billion a year. We're against the UN Population Fund. They've got $1 billion a year. We're against the World Health Organization. We're against the European Union and all those powerful countries, Germany, France, the Nordic countries, so on and so forth. We're up against the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and there's no global right to abortion because we stopped them. I'm going to take a little time out and tell you a story. All this wall of words about policy can get a little tedious. I'm going to tell you a story. This happened years ago at the United Nations. It was before a major UN conference. We are at the UN so much we know all the back doors and back stairs. And so the doors open in the morning at 7 a.m., and there was a little group of us, and we came in through this side door that I know, up the stairs, through another locked door, into the balcony over this massive negotiating room like the General Assembly Hall. And among us was a Catholic priest, some Mormons, evangelicals, Catholics. The priest, Father Kazimir Kowalski, God rest his soul, laid out his material, and he intoned the words of exorcism. And the prayers for the blessing of a building of communication. And at the UN is on the East River, and they have these huge windows overlooking the East River. And at that moment, the sun came up. And right as he was doing that, the sun came up and, like, blasted into this room where we were. And it was like God telling us, this is good. This is good. And shortly thereafter, the doors down below started rattling and rattling and rattling, and it, like demons were trying to get out. And it was people coming to the meeting. It was demons coming in. So what is it that we do? We lobby. In the beginning when this group went to the Cairo conference, man, we didn't know anything. I wasn't there, but the people that founded CFAM were. We didn't know anything. We'd never seen a UN document or talked to a UN diplomat or anything like that. I mean, it's kind of scary. And so what happens is the bad guys write the first draft of the document, and it's like this thick, and it's loaded up with bad stuff. And on the first day of negotiations, all the amendments are added, and then it's that thick. And it's nothing but bad stuff. Reproductive health, reproductive rights, even abortion, and all sorts of trick language. And the process then is we whisper in the ears of diplomats and try to convince them to take certain things out, which they do. Mostly we try to convince them to be brave and to stand up to the European Union and the UN agencies, and they do. So that is what we do. We mostly... In the early days, we didn't really know anything. Now we know a lot. We've lost a little bit of the amateur spirit that we had in those, let's put on a play, that kind of great thing that, like a Mickey Rooney movie. Anybody old enough to remember Mickey Rooney movies? Thank you for being here. Now it's like we're experts in international law. So it's like my guy, Stefano Generini, he's been with me for 10 years. He went to the Notre Dame Law School. I mean, he's an advisor to major UN delegations, and they call him and ask him what to do about certain things. And, he's on the phone constantly during negotiations, including this week at the Commission on the Status of Women. So we lobby, we advise, we publicize. My organization puts out a weekly report called the Friday Facts. Any subscribers to the Friday Facts? Here's a couple. Here's more. Any donors here? Kidding. Not really. The Friday Facts goes to, 300,000 people a week, every Thursday afternoon. It comes out on Thursday, and it's not a fax. So anyway, Friday Facts is what it used to be. In the beginning, I used to feed it in one by one every Friday morning into the fax machine. The people in Australia were very annoyed about that, because it would come in the middle of the night. Were you an early subscriber? Really? Wow. So we publicize. And we tell people what really happens at the United Nations because most people don't know. When they know, they really care, you know? The United Nations is trying to impose an international right to abortion on sovereign states all over the world. That's what really goes on there. I'm going to take a time out for another story. It's story time. Years ago, a Washington Post reporter asked me about our work with the Muslims. And we work very closely with Muslim delegations. And I said to this reporter, and he printed it, I said, you know, they're not really our friends, they're our allies. And the head of the Egyptian delegation took umbrage of that because he considered that we were friends, you know? And he was right. And I was just being kind of sophisticated, you know what I mean? And so I wrote a speech that I gave to a room full of Muslim diplomats called I'd Rather There Be Muslims in My Foxhole. And a part of that talk was that I told them that God wanted all of them to become Catholic. And they did exactly what you did. They love that. They love strong faith. And that's one of the things about our coalition at the United Nations. I call it the true ecumenism, because we're all people of strong faith, you know? You know, I work with people who think that I'm not only theologically wrong, but damnably wrong, you know? And I don't care, because they're good on the issues, and that's what we need at the United Nations, is somebody who can stand up and say no to the EU, to Germany, France, to the UN agencies. So the issues are abortion, sexual orientation, gender identity, and the family. Those are the overarching issues that they're keenly interested in. They want to establish an international right to abortion. They want to have sexual orientation and gender identity as a new category of non-discrimination in international law. And you know what happens if, you know what follows if that happens is, when you stack up sexual orientation and gender identity as a human right up against freedom of religion, who loses? Of course, freedom of religion loses. So we have been able to stop sexual orientation and gender identity from becoming a new category of non-discrimination. We have stopped a redefinition of the family. They have tried so many tricks with regard to family, that various forms of the family exist. You know, on and on and on and on, and they never stop. They never stop. We also work on gender. You know, there's a really good definition of gender in international law that we help negotiate. You want to know what it is? Yes. In the Beijing document from the Mists of Time, it says gender is to be understood as it has traditionally been understood. That's pretty good. Isn't that good? Now, a couple of years later, we were negotiating the International Criminal Court. We did not support the creation of the International Criminal Court, but we participated in the negotiation of the document that established it because we wanted to make sure certain things were not in it, like a right to abortion, which we stopped there too. But there was a big debate about gender, and the definition of gender in hard law is men and women in the context of society. And they hate that. They are trying to get a new treaty, a new human rights treaty, for the sole purpose of changing that definition. And that's something that this ragtag band of Christians did 20 years ago. It's phenomenal what you can do when you go to the meeting and stay to the very end. That's one of my tips at the end. Go to the meeting and stay to the very end. And if you can, write the minutes. The larger issues are national sovereignty and international law. You know, national sovereignty is one of the things that most countries care deeply about. And what the United Nations wants to do is to invade national sovereignty and decide these questions for them. This is why they write all these hundreds of documents, because they can't get a hard law treaty saying that there's an international right to abortion. They can't. If there was an up or down vote at the United Nations on abortion, they would lose. And so what they do is they try tricks of language in all of these non-binding resolutions that should have no force in law, and they don't. But The claim of the other side is the repetitious use of the phrase reproductive health and reproductive rights and sexual rights in non-binding documents has established an international right to these things through what is known as customary international law. I'm going to be really brief on this because I'm going to put you all to sleep. Customary international law is the idea that something becomes law when there is universal common practice with the understanding that you have a legal obligation to do so. So it doesn't have to be written down. It's common practice among the nations of the world. And so they claim that the repetitious use of reproductive health agreed to in non-binding UN resolutions has created a customary international right to abortion. Of course, this is false. Let me tell you another story. At Beijing Plus Five some years ago, we accredited, 300 people. I mentioned that a minute ago. And among them, we accredited 20 members of Father Groeschel's Franciscan Friars of the Renewal. Bull robes, you know, it was beautiful. There's like 5,000, you know, crazy feminists at this meeting, which is going on right now, but this is some years ago. And so we had Franciscan Friars of the Renewal. And the other thing that we did at that conference was we had little red buttons made up that simply said motherhood. It drove the other side crazy. Imagine. It was like waving, you know, the red flag in front of the bull. You know, it was beautiful. So here, Franciscan Friars of the Renewal in their full gray robes wearing the little red motherhood buttons. So that's the scene. So outside the conference room, everybody's milling around, you know, hundreds of people milling around in the lobby. And over on a couch is one of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal sitting there talking intently with this woman from Latin America. And he tells us later that she asked him this: "I am very wealthy. I am very well known in my country. I am very powerful. But I'm also very unhappy. Can you tell me why?" Yeah. And he said, "Because you don't know Jesus Christ." At which point, she shrieked in pain, so loud and so jarring that all of her friends stormed over and demanded to know what the Franciscan friar had said to their friend. She waved them away. And she and the friar stayed on that couch talking nose to nose for a very long time. And we won't know the end of the story until the general judgment. But I have to think it's a happy ending. Don't you? Yeah. So that's also who we are. We are people of faith. There are ladies who come to these UN conferences only to pray. The praying ladies. They pray for courage of the diplomats, that they can stand up to the might of the European Union and the UN agencies and the hectoring feminists. This last fall at the General Assembly, there were efforts to call reproductive health a human right. And the opposition to this rested solely with a handful of African countries. Imagine that. These poor African countries, Nigeria, who desperately need money from the donor countries, standing up to the donor countries and fighting back and saying, no, we lost that debate. However, 60 countries at the end issued formal statements condemning the vote that day. And it made it abundantly clear that the claim of the other side, that there is a consensus on reproductive health at the United Nations, was blown to smithereens. This was a victory within a loss. So, right now, the Commission on the Status of Women is happening. The negotiations started actually a couple of weeks ago. We've got about 100 people there. They've got about 5,000. We like the odds. Because we beat them every single time. You know, and they issued these guidelines about a month ago. There's an NGO track, there's a negotiating track, and then there's like a parallel track where government sponsored conferences. The NGOs, the radical feminist NGOs, blocked us from even participating in their track. So we partnered with a number of governments to put on panels. Protecting Children Online was one of them the other night. It was jam-packed, and the feminists harassed our speakers, yelled and screamed. You know, they always say, you know, we're a little bit afraid of them because they make us feel unsafe. Well, how do they make you feel unsafe? Well, because, you know, they disagree with us. But here they are at our conference yelling and screaming at our speakers from across the room. It was amazing. And then last night, you're going to love this, we worked with Matt Walsh's organization to put on What is a Woman at the UN. And it was jam-packed, and it will have an impact on the negotiations next week, I guarantee you. If you go to the Daily Wire, they've got a story up about it this morning. So that's what's happening right now. So let me close with some lessons. The pro-life and pro-family movement is broad and deep and vast, and there is something for everybody to do. You know, it's phenomenal what people cook up at their kitchen table. You know, Lila Rose sat around her dorm room at UCLA and cooked up the idea of making funny phone calls to Planned Parenthood. And look what she has become. Look what she created. There's something for everybody. If I was on the political left but still pro-life, I know that's rare, but if I was, I would go after insurance companies. You know, the big bad corporations who fund abortion. I would go after them. You know, there are even things that you can do from the left that are pro-life and anti-abortion. There's something for everybody to do. Grab a broom. Don't lean. Clean, they used to say when I worked at Dairy Queen back in the day. By the way, it's not on my it's not in my bio, but if you go to Wikipedia and look up cheese fries, I invented cheese fries at the Dairy Queen on First Capitol Drive in St. Charles, Missouri, in the mid-70s. You can go there now and look. And I thank you. To this day, I get a nickel for every order of cheese fries ordered anywhere. Another lesson. Do not be overly concerned with wins and losses. Enjoy the action, you know? It's like when my guys walk into the room, the air goes right out. That's a win, you know? Just ruin the other guy's day just by showing up. And don't, you know, people go into this, some people go into this work and they don't win, and then they leave and they go do something else. And it's like all of those losses are meaningful for a whole lot of reasons, including establishing a predicate for later victories. And also so at the general judgment, you can find out about the lives that you change. I'm obsessed with the general judgment. It's where you all are going to find out I was right about everything. My wife especially loves it when I say that. And I will just close finally by saying that there's never been a finer time to be a faithful Catholic. There's never been a finer time to be a faithful Christian than right now. And it's not because, it's not in spite of all the troubles around us, but it's precisely because of them. And I'll close the way I began. He sent us. And that is a remarkable thing. I'm such a loser, I can't get dates straight. Yet I participated in stopping a global right to abortion. How crazy is that? So I'll just close there and say, there's never been a finer time to be in this work. And God bless all of you for being here on a Saturday morning.
Come on. He deserves a standing ovation for the cheese fries alone, right? By the way, how many people here grabbed your phone when he told you to look up Wikipedia? He wasn't kidding. Another report claims that a young fry cook named Austin Roos was the first to serve this dish while working at Dairy Queen in St. Charles, Missouri.
And I'll just point out there are two footnotes, so it's in there forever.
And if you do get a nickel for every order, I'm paying your mortgage. We have a bunch of wonderful questions here. We're going to take with Austin for the next 10 minutes or so. A reminder, just have to say this before every Q&A. If you don't hear your question, don't take it personally and don't think that it's going to go for naught. Molly will read all questions on these cards in subsequent interviews on From the Media and her radio program. In an upcoming interview with Austin. So, Austin Roos, thank you for the presentation. Tremendously inspiring. And I love that you kicked the UN's behind. Okay, our first question. Now, some of these are a little tough to read, so I apologize. I actually can read, but I can't necessarily make out all handwriting. Pope Francis is advocating for LGBTQ rights, women as deacons. He has told Catholics to, quote, stop having babies like rabbits. And also the UN, the nuncio at the UN is going against Catholic teaching. How do you deal with these issues and with them, including the Pope?
I thought you were going to screen these questions.
That's Kate's job.
Gosh, I remember, a decade ago, I was at the UN with the then nuncio, Archbishop Chulakot, when we were at a conference and all of our phones started pinging and lighting up because the white smoke had rose, you know? And it was like shortly there. We went to the cafeteria and watched as Francis was announced. Yeah, I'm not going to say anything about Francis. I'll just say this. He has roundly and consistently condemned the transgender ideology. He has done that. He's done some things that confuse me mightily, but he has done that. I think this opening of the door to homosexuality is a huge mistake anywhere, including in the church. All of us are sinners. Golly, I'm a convert and a revert. You know, I have. I wasn't ready to clean up my room. So the church welcomed me back, you know, and you all probably feel the same. So anybody with that particular proclivity, of course, is welcome. But you're not welcome to fly your flag in the church. And any move toward that, I think, is a huge mistake. I'm a public opponent of Father James Martin. And maybe I let Pope Francis off the hook a little bit, but I wrote a column now a couple of years ago that I postulated that if Pope Francis wanted to know what the hubbub about Father James Martin was all about, do you think anybody would tell him, oh, call Austin Roos? You know, they would call Spadaro, call these guys that love him, who surround the Pope, and they're not going to tell him that James Martin has said that he looks forward to married gays kissing at the sign of peace. The Pope is not going to know that. Now, some people say I'm letting him off the hook. Of course he knows that. I don't know. I don't think he knows that. So he said a lot of confusing things. The Holy See mission to the United Nations, I'm not quite sure what that's in reference to. The Holy See mission to the United Nations has been central in stopping a global right to abortion at the UN for 25 years. They used to be a lot more aggressive, and they've stepped back in terms of publicly leading the fight, but they're still in the fight. Yeah.
Question number two. Should conservatives place a higher priority on defunding the UN, included in the Republican platform? And if the UN was defunded, what do you think would be the consequences?
You know, I'm of two minds on that. On the one hand, I say, yeah, do it. On the other hand, every time we do that, the European Union steps in and doubles whatever we pulled out. You know, so it's never really worked. That's the problem with that. It's like, you know, the funding UNFPA is a political football. you know, on the first day of a Republican administration, they defund UNFPA, and then the EU steps in and replaces that and then doubles it. And then on the first day of a Democratic administration, they fund UNFPA. The UNFPA is a UN agency. They're sort of their population control abortion agency. It's a wicked organization. I'm of two minds. I'm of two minds.
Next question. President Biden said this is the new world order and the U.S. will lead it. Are we close to one world government, and is that prepping the scene for the Antichrist?
I don't know about the Antichrist. But with regard to one world government, I used to poo-poo that idea. They talk a lot about this thing called global governance at the United Nations and at the EU. And then I look at what's going on with Klaus Schwab and the Great Reset and things like that. I think it's very clear that there are people in this world. Hello. There are people in this world that want to tell you what to do. The little girl there. Without a doubt, there are people in this world who want to rule the world, and they're all the smart guys who look down on us. I think that at the heart of our work, it's resisting. You know what gets me going is righteous anger that there are people at the United Nations who spend their days trying to think of ways to tell us what to do. it's like, how dare you? I just have, in the last 4 years, I got to tell you, it's made me even more anti-government. It's like that there are people who really want to rule our lives down to the narrowest level. And that's one of the things that gets me going every day for 25 years is I object at the heart. The life issue is important. Family, important. The main drivers of what we do. But at the heart of it, it's that these middle-class bureaucrats want to run our lives. I can't stand that. I can't stand that. Yeah.
Next question. How do we, as American citizens, stand up against evil global organizations such as the UN, the World Economic Forum, the WHO, etc., in a practical way?
Over the many, many years that I've been out on the hustings telling the story of CFAM and our work at the United Nations, I always get this question. And my answer has always been, and now it's even more prescient, stay home and take over the school board. That's what you ought to be doing. If you want to come to the UN and work with us, you're welcome to. We'll show you what to do. We'll show you how to do it. You can join us. Not everybody is called to it. It's really expensive. If you're visiting New York, you're going to be paying. Maybe you could stay at the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal, which a lot of people do, or the Dominicans, which a lot of people do. But still, it's onerous. So I stay home and take over the school board. So I said this for years and years, and then my wife got involved in the school board, and she said, "Can I run for the school board?" And I said, "No." My wife is a real hero on the school board issue. She was, when the Fairfax County School Board was instituting their transgender policy now 5 years ago, before all of this action started, my wife was involved. And she and her friends would go to the school board meeting every 2 weeks on a Thursday night and occupy every speaking slot. It was so beautiful. It was like, and every single question that they would ask would be related. They're supposed to be on the agenda. So if the agenda was the budget, they would say, I'm here to talk about the budget item that you're going to spend on transgenderism. It's like no matter what it was, they would twist it to that. And then COVID came and critical race theory. And to me, all that in some policy level has been a blessing because it's created thousands of Phyllis Schlafly's. Thousands of Molly Smiths. It's like we need more of that. Radicalized moms. I was at a private consultation at the Heritage Foundation on gender ideology, a month ago, and there were 100 people there. Almost every single one was a mom who was recently radicalized by, because CRT, it finally got onto people's radar screens that something was wrong in the schools, and they started looking at the curricula, and then they would go down the rat hole. And, the UN. The UN is involved in this. And become radicalized. I turned to a woman at this conference and I said, "How long have you been doing this?" She was amazing. She was an expert. And she goes, "A year and a half." There's no stopping a radicalized mom.
Austin, next question. We actually had a presentation on yesterday, but we'd like your thoughts on it. You mentioned right to abortion and gender rights. What about rights to assisted suicide and euthanasia?
You know, it's not something that we work on because it's not something that is on the agenda at the UN. Oddly, why is that? I don't know. But over the years, it's just never come up. It's just never come up. One of the blessings given to my colleagues and I is we've always stayed like a laser focus on the UN, international social policy. If it's not those two things, we don't get involved. So, we're not involved in judges. And I mean, as people we are. But as an organization, you know, it's like we're not involved in things that don't come to the United Nations. So it's not at the UN.
Can anyone go to the UN meetings?
Can anyone go to a UN meeting? Mm-hmm. No. You need to have a badge, which means that you have to be get a badge from an accredited UN NGO, which we are. There are about 25 UN NGOs, pro-life and pro-family groups that have been accredited to the United Nations, accredited with the UN Economic and Social Council is what it's called. And when you come to a UN meeting, you would get a badge from us.
And because I'm sure whoever wrote that card is wondering, how would one get a badge from you?
Well, you just have to get in touch. And, you know, the UN schedule is this. From January until the spring is what I call commission season, the Commission on the Status of Women, the Commission on Social Development, the Commission on Population and Development. All of those have documents that are negotiated by UN member states. We go to all of them. We can accredit anybody to any of them. And then in the summertime is what's known as the high-level political meeting, which negotiates a document. It's all they do there. And then in the fall is the General Assembly. So if somebody wants to come to a UN meeting, just get in touch with me, and we can arrange it.
Do you know, will they still put us up at posh New York hotels if we identify as illegal immigrants? I'm just saying, if we're going to go, we might as well go in style.
You have to leave the country and walk across, and then
There you go. Then they'll put us up for free.
You know, it's funny because they're putting people up in a hotel there near Times Square that used to be called the Milford Plaza. That was my hotel when I would come to New York from. I used to work for American Film Magazine in Washington, and used to fly back and forth all the time. And I stayed at the room 1516 in the Milford Plaza Hotel.
It might not be the way you remember it now, just from what they say. Austin, who pays for the reproductive health kits?
Well, the reproductive health kits would be paid for by UNFPA in this particular instance, and UNFPA's budget comes from member states. So UNFPA has donor countries who give them, you know, I don't know what their current budget is. It's at least $1 billion a year. So all of this stuff comes from donor countries that give to UNFPA.
Here's an interesting one. Besides population control, why do you think so many powerful countries are so in favor of abortion, especially in African countries? It cannot just be evil.
Man, that's a really good question. That, you know, I often say that we need to take them at their word that they believe that women won't be free until they can kill their unborn child. You know, because that's what they say. So we can believe them. You know, I do believe that that population control is a big part of it. I think that they truly believe that economies will not grow if there's a high fertility rate. Of course, history shows that this is false. I think that a lot of it has to do with power and control, that they like the idea of telling African countries what to do, you know. So I think there's a whole lot of reasons that they push abortion on African countries, Asian countries. I think there's a lot of reasons, including population control, radical feminism, the idea that this is the only way that they're going to be free, the control of elites on poorer people. Yeah.
Two more. Is your organization fighting the WHO concerning the loss of national sovereignty with announcements of pandemics, lockdowns, forced vaccinations, et cetera?
Oh, yes. Well, we're very involved in opposing the World Health Organization on the pandemic question. There is actually a hard law treaty that's being that is in the beginning stages of negotiation, which will give a tremendous amount of power to the World Health Organization to call global emergencies. So we're very involved in that. We've been reporting on the World Health Organization and abortion for 25 years. So yeah, we're very involved in the World Health Organization. It's ramped up recently because of the pandemic.
Okay, last one for you, Austin. What other big organizations like UNICEF that seek donations are for and promoting abortion at the UN conference or conferences? And what about Catholic groups?
What about who?
Catholic groups.
Catholic groups. Well, I mean, you can just look at the UN flowchart and see all the big UN agencies, the World Bank, the World Health Organization, UNFPA. There's a great big organization called UN Women, which is, you know, a $1 billion agency. It's almost brand new. They're one of the prime drivers of the radical feminist agenda at the United Nations. Are there Catholic groups? Golly, you know, there are religious congregations that are accredited to the United Nations, but they, I hate to say this, they don't really get involved in our issues. You know, they're involved in, you know, poverty and things like that, but they're generally silent on what is the number one issue at the United Nations, which is reproductive health. You know, reproductive health and reproductive rights appears in every single document that's negotiated at the United Nations. It's like the number one issue. So a lot of the religious congregations are silent. Yeah.
Terrific. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, please, a round of applause for Austin Roos.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to see you.
You've been listening to Austin Roos, president of the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, CFAM, and a 2023 presenter at the Bringing America Back to Life convention.
From the Median is listener-supported. Visit our website, fromthemedian.org, for further information or to make a donation to continue to make this radio program possible. Email us, radionews@fromthemedian.org, or call 440-668-4049. Through our FromTheMedian.org website, you can download this or previous programs for your listening pleasure or sign up to receive our weekly preview of upcoming guest interviews. Tune in every weeknight at the same time to listen to another great interview on From the Median as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life.
This program has been sponsored by Cleveland Right to Life and is responsible for its content.